it's hard for me to go back to my constituents and then justify cutting their PFD just to pay for those oil tax subsidies.
Can a bill that would reduce Alaskans' PFDs pass the House? From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, federal guidance that will make it easier for Alaska Natives to adopt Native children in state custody.
These rules are providing a lot more clarity to areas of practice that have been somewhat gray and open for interpretation. So I think it's going to help reduce potentially future litigation.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs will return to using its own employees to make appointments for Alaska veterans who need services outside the VA system. Alaska's congressional delegation made the announcement today. VA officials in Alaska did not return phone calls seeking comment. Vets have complained of severe problems trying to make appointments through TriWest. That's the contractor hired to administer the Choice program. Congress created Choice with the goal of shrinking VA wait lists by allowing vets to get service through the private sector. In Alaska, though, Choice seemed to create more problems than it solved. Vets complained of poor response from TriWest call centers, and many medical specialists refused to provide service through the Choice program. Alaska's congressional delegation says ending the contractor's duty to make appointments only fixes part of the problem, since TriWest is still responsible for billing and maintaining relationships with medical professionals. The bill that would cut Alaskans' permanent fund dividend checks in half this fall will face a tough legislative test this week. While the Senate passed its version of the bill, the House version may not make it through the House Finance Committee. Lawmakers from both ends of the political spectrum are raising concerns with the measure. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO in Juneau reports.
The bill would allow the state to draw more than $1.5 billion from permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. It's the centerpiece of Governor Bill Walker's plan, intended to bring fiscal stability to state government and the economy. It would work like an endowment, with about 5% of the fund going toward the state budget each year. Juneau Republican Representative Kathy Munoz says the bill would help the state's economy by stabilizing government and bolstering the state's credit rating.
It's very important that we sustain our services and that we provide a reliable and predictable source of revenue for state services.
Munoz also says the bill would protect permanent fund dividends. That's because if the state doesn't close its deficit, it would exhaust the fund earnings account that pays for dividends in roughly 6 years. But it's hard to make that case to Alaskans, who are facing a cut from what was expected to be about $2,000 this fall to $1,000 under the bill. Many residents have been making their voices heard since the Senate passed its version of the bill last week, calling on House members to oppose the cut. That's sharpened opposition that's coming from both conservative Republicans and minority caucus Democrats. Fairbanks Democratic Representative Scott Kawasaki opposes the bill. Before reconsidering his position, Kawasaki would like to see Walker press the legislature to make deeper cuts to tax credits to North Slope oil producers.
I have some real troubles, especially in light of the oil tax subsidy bill that passed, which is hundreds of millions of dollars. It's hard for me to go back to my constituents and then justify cutting their PFD just to pay for those oil tax subsidies.
Anchorage Democrat Andy Josephson would like to see the bill amended to lift the limit on the combined amount of revenue from fund earnings and the oil and gas industry. The limit wouldn't adjust for inflation, which could sharply limit government spending over time.
I'm not going to support a bill that has a spending cap that would change the way historically we've done business when we look at the budget each year. That is, we have an ongoing debate about the ability to fund certain programs and the need for those programs.
But some conservative representatives oppose the bill for a different reason. They say the legislature hasn't gone far enough to cut the size of government to justify reducing PFDs and drawing money from fund earnings. Wasilla Republican Lynn Gaddis is among the Finance Committee members who oppose the bill.
It's not about Alaskans not willing to pay their way, but it's more about Alaskans saying the moment we backfill it, there will not be the will to continue the necessary cuts.
The House Finance Committee is scheduled to hold a hearing on the bill Tuesday morning. If the bill does make it out of committee, other representatives like Healy Republican David Tallarico will have to weigh in. Tallarico says the bill presents a real dilemma.
It's very difficult for every legislator to think about changing the structure of the permanent fund, but I'm also very concerned with our credit rating as a state.
While lawmakers are hearing from constituents opposed to the bill, Walker administration officials, as well as officials with groups that support the bill like the AFL-CIO, are also reaching out to them. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Under new federal guidance, it will be easier for potential Alaska Native and Native American parents to adopt Native children in state custody. The 360-page rule issued by the Bureau of Indian Affairs last week aims to make interpretation of the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, more consistent regardless of the state, judge, or social worker involved. KTOO's Jennifer Canfield has more.
With the new BIA regulations, state courts across the country must now establish at the beginning whether the placement of a child is subject to the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA.
This is going to be just entirely helpful for us.
That's Christy Lawton, director of the Alaska Office of Children's Services, or OCS.
These rules are providing a lot more clarity to areas of practice that have been somewhat gray and open for interpretation. So I think it's going to help reduce potentially future litigation.
The rules likely would have prevented litigation in the Tanunic case by requiring ICWA eligibility to have been determined at the outset. In 2015, the Alaska Supreme Court declined to reconsider a case in which a Native child, dubbed Baby Dawn, was permanently placed into a non-Native home. The child's grandmother told the state that she wanted to adopt her, but the state argued that since the grandmother did not formally file paperwork, there was no ICWA placement preference to apply. Matt Newman is an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund, which represented the grandmother in the case. Newman says there's a pattern of Native children being moved to Anchorage or other urban centers. The thinking is that there are more services there to help a child and parent, improving chances of reunification. But when that isn't possible, Newman says the court often decides that the foster care family bond should not be broken. Those children do not return to their home villages.
We saw these situations where time and time again, children were being placed in Anchorage or Matsu or on the Rail Belt road system under the premise that they would be returned or reunified with their communities and their families, only to have the opposite eventually happened, that once you're in Anchorage or once you're in the urban centers, you stay there.
That scenario happens far less frequently, Newman says, since Valerie Davidson, a Yupik woman with a background in healthcare and law, became commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. Her department oversees OCS.
I think our biggest opportunity is really the opportunity to leverage our relationships with tribes and tribal organizations to really improve outcomes for Alaska Native and American Indian children in our communities.
That's Commissioner Davidson.
When you can provide that care as close to home as possible, we know that we are going to have better outcomes for children. And tribes are really in the best position to be able to provide that local care.
In March 2015, under Davidson's guidance, the state issued emergency regulations that essentially formalized any contact regarding the immediate placement of a child. That meant if a grandmother called OCS and told them that she wanted to take care of her grandchild, that phone call would be documented as a formal request to initiate adoption or foster care placement. Legislators codified those emergency regulations last month in House Bill 200. Governor Bill Walker made it a priority for the legislature. The Alaska Federation of Natives strongly advocated for the bill. Nicole Borromeo is an executive vice president and general counsel for AFN.
We're encouraged by the Department of Interior releasing these BIA guidelines in regulation, and we are looking forward to the state courts complying with the regulations because they're no longer guidance. They are, in fact, federal regulations, and they are binding.
In 1978, Congress adopted the Indian Child Welfare Act to remedy the high rate of removal of children from their homes. The The new federal regulations clarify what has been for decades a murky and often divisive law. Newman, the Native American Rights Fund attorney, noted that coincidentally, the regulations were announced within 2 days of the anniversary of the state court declining to reconsider the Tununic case. In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, at the beginning of Pride Week, Juneau residents grapple with the mass shooting in Orlando.
At the same time, I mean, it doesn't help you wrap your head around it. You can't read enough to understand why anyone would do something like that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to four-year colleges or other post-secondary education. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
Members of Juneau's LGBTQ community celebrated the second day of Pride Week with a picnic at a local park. The festive mood was darkened by collective mourning for victims of a mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando. KTOO's Quentin Chandler has more.
At least 50 people were killed in Orlando early Sunday. Jeff Rogers says he learned about the tragedy earlier that morning and it blew him away.
Hi, I'm Jeff.
It hits home awfully deep for the queer community during Pride to see an event like that. Our heart goes out to the victims and the families and everybody involved.
Rogers is attending the Southeast Alaska LGBTQ Alliance's 30th anniversary Pride picnic. He says the shooting in Orlando reminds him why the LGBTQ community celebrates Pride.
We celebrate Pride in memory of and as a commemoration of Stonewall, where gays and trans women were victimized and brutalized in nightclubs in New York.
The Stonewall riots of 1969 are widely recognized as the start of the modern gay civil rights movement. The riots began when gay men and women resisted arrest in New York's Greenwich Village during a police raid of a well-known gay bar at the time, the Stonewall Inn. Rogers says, in a way, Pride has always been about overcoming adversity and will continue to be as the country recovers from the attack on the gay nightclub Pulse Orlando. Richard Carter and Heather Laverne were also struck by the timing of the attack.
You can't be selfish except for in hindsight, but I felt a little bit selfish to be out celebrating when other people were experiencing that.
I woke up and read an article about it, and I just started doing all this research, reading, and looking to see what I could find out, but at the same time, I mean, it doesn't help you wrap your head around it. You can't read enough to understand why anyone would do something like that.
State Representatives Sam Keto, Kathy Munoz, and Juneau Deputy Mayor Jesse Keel offered words of encouragement to picnic goers, denounced the attack in Orlando, and Keel and Munoz highlighted policy changes they've proposed to support LGBTQ rights. Munoz is a sponsor of a bill to prohibit discrimination against sexual orientation in the state, and Keel has proposed a similar Juneau ordinance.
Right now, there's nothing in Juneau law that prohibits discrimination based on race or sex or sexual orientation or pretty much anything else. And that's a gap in our law here in the capital city.
Keel says his ordinance would plug gaps in protection on all those fronts, as well as for marital status, age, disability, and gender identity.
And it will apply in housing, it'll apply in credit, it will apply in the workforce, and it'll apply to public accommodation.
Keel says he's been told by a number of people that discrimination is a problem in Juneau, and he says the State Human Rights Commission gets 24 complaints of discrimination from Juneau each year. Carter agrees discrimination should be outlawed in Juneau. He says everyone, no matter their color, sex, or sexual orientation, is mindful of whether the community they move or travel to will be tolerant.
Even if you're just going on vacation out of the country, you pick countries that you know you're not going to be attacked or oppressed in. I've been called faggot on the streets of Juneau, but it doesn't happen very often, and I don't feel in danger here, and I don't feel unwelcome here. I think overall Juneau's been an amazing place.
Keel's ordinance is scheduled for introduction to the Juneau City Assembly Monday. The public will have an opportunity to testify on the ordinance June 21st. In Juneau, I'm Quentin Chandler.
A block party in Big Lake on Saturday drew happy crowds, but there was an underlying somber theme to the event. The day was dedicated to those firefighters and community residents who faced the big one, the Miller's Reach blaze of 20 years ago. Kids, dogs, and adults roamed amid balloons, munching free hot dogs in a typical small-town festival setting. Blustery winds and overcast skies did little to dampen their enthusiasm as they admired the fleet of shiny red or yellow fire trucks lined up in front of the West Lakes Fire Station in Big Lake. But the theme of the event, wildfire safety, could not have been more serious. Commemoration of the firefighters who corralled the Miller's Reach fire and brought it to a halt.
It spread 3 miles in the first 20 minutes.
That's Mark Bertels, the initial incident commander on Miller's Reach 20 years ago.
Flame heights were over 200 feet, with random secondary combustion of fire-generated gases above the moving fire, pushed by 50-mile-an-hour winds, creating dozens of spot fires ahead of its path. Hot embers were carried all the way across Cook Inlet, landing at the Anchorage port. They had to close the docks down.
Bill Gamble, now Matanuska Susitna Borough Emergency Services Director, was on the fire line in June of 1996.
I remember standing on Beaver Lake Road the first night and watching a 200-foot wall of flame cross the road and almost take out a couple of fire trucks and about 10 firefighters, and that was probably the most harrowing moment for me during the whole Miller's Reach event. I thought for sure that my crew was going to perish on Beaver Lake Road.
Firemen told stories of that day when the fire raced from near Houston through parts of Big Lake to threaten Knik Goose Bay Road near Wasilla. But a lot has changed in two decades, and the devastating fire taught fire managers a lot. Norm McDonald, who helped fight the fire and is now a state fire manager, says Miller's Reach was unprecedented and underscored the weaknesses in firefighting capability at the time.
And probably more importantly, we work with the borough very closely. So we got a very strong team, and the teamwork we have with these guys is a lot further ahead than it was in 96, and every year it gets stronger. And we had Sockeye Fire last year. We lost a lot of homes. It was devastating for a lot of people, but I look at our response and the way we responded to that as a team compared to 96, where we were trying to figure out how to work together, is night and day.
Kathy Kramer lost her home to the fire and now works to educate people about defensible space through the FireWise program. Kramer organized Saturday's event and unveiled a new plaque in front of the West Lakes Fire Station.
This is a dedication to the entire community of Big Lake for being resilient and coming back strong. And so this is for Big Lake. It says Miller's Reach Fire. And the statement that we came up is, most of all, we saw the best of people.
Dedicating the plaque was the centerpiece of Saturday's event. The Miller's Reach Fire was the first major urban interface wildfire fought in Alaska. It burned 37,000 acres and destroyed 454 structures, most of them homes. It was thought to have been caused by fireworks. Tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of the Sockeye wildfire, which drove Willow residents from their homes and claimed 55 residences. Defendants in a case now pending in state court will face trial, according to the outcome of a pretrial hearing held on Friday. Attorneys for Greg Imig and Amy DeWitt say they will not accept a plea bargain offered by the state. Palmer District Attorney Roman Kolachek said 2 weeks ago that the state was attempting to negotiate to avoid a month-long trial. The state has charged Imig and DeWitt with criminally negligent burning and reckless endangerment. All the charges against the couple are misdemeanors and do not carry voluntary jail time. Kalachek says restitution for the fire is a sticking point in the plea deal. The state wants to go to trial by July, but attorneys for the defendants say they want to wait until October.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. The Resource Basket is a training and technical assistance center helping rural communities support healthy, resilient, and culturally connected youth. Tribes and youth-serving organizations can request support, explore resources, and find opportunities at resourcebasket.org or call the team directly at 1-800-478-7227, extension 7396. This message sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
With its limited road system, Southeast doesn't seem like a paradise for car lovers, but it might be perfect for one kind of driver. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports how the region might be the perfect spot for electric vehicles.
Oh, I have to push the brake.
Travis McCain is the enthusiastic owner of a 2013 black sedan.
Heated seats, heated steering wheel. Heated rear seats.
But he hasn't been to the gas pump in months, ever since he bought the all-electric Nissan Leaf.
Do you ever gun it to like 90?
Oh yeah.
When he bought the car back in February, he tried to shop locally.
I went to all the dealerships in town and said, what can you do that is similar to this Nissan Leaf? And nobody had quite that answer.
So he bought the car from Washington and had it barged up. He says he wanted the car to help cut fuel costs. The electricity for the vehicle is only about 2 cents a mile. The positive environmental impact was the icing on the cake. And in Southeast, there's one thing he doesn't have to worry about, something that does worry drivers in the lower 48.
Range anxiety that is associated with the car, which I never really had. It's Juno, you know, if it gets stuck somewhere, oh well, I'll call a friend.
But even that scenario is unlikely, because along Juno's nearly 60 miles of road, there are a lot of plugs.
There's a single charging station with two plugs at Eagle Beach, the UAS campus, Pinhall Valley Public Library, single station, two plugs.
Alec Mezdag is a director at the Alaska Electric Light and Power Company. In 2014, he worked with the city's Economic Development Council to help identify the locations for the public charging stations, which were grant-funded. There are now 10. Mezdag says at first, some criticized the charging stations as a handout. The electricity is free, and the city doesn't give away gasoline.
While that analogy is out there, the biggest difference is that the expense is so different. You know, I mean, it would literally cost the city more to administer the collection of funds than it would just to give the electricity away.
Mezdag says Alaska's capital currently ranks with places like Austin, Texas, and Portland, Oregon, when it comes to plugs per capita. But he thinks Juneau has the advantage.
In all honesty, a lot of that just has to do with the fact that we're really much better suited for the vehicles than a lot of those other communities.
That's because what some see as an oddity, the city's remoteness, is actually a superpower for electric vehicles. There's just not that far to drive. Still, it can be a pain to ship the cars here or have them repaired. Groups in Juneau and Sitka are trying to organize regular visits from technicians. And soon there might be enough electric cars to warrant the trip. Mezdag says there's a new Nissan Leaf arriving just about every week.
We'll be close to 100 EVs in Juneau by the end of the year.
Doubling the number of electric vehicles, or EVs, on the road. This couldn't work everywhere in the state. Fully electric vehicles can have issues in colder climates. And it requires cheap, or relatively cheap, electricity, which means it doesn't make much sense in regions that rely on expensive diesel. But in Southeast communities with lower-cost hydropower, like Juneau, Sitka, and Petersburg, electric vehicles pencil out. Mezdag thinks they could start to become the new norm.
A year ago, I would have been less sure that this was going to happen. Word of mouth is a big sales tool, and we have a lot of people who own these vehicles now, and they are pretty happy with their experience.
My sister, Ariel Gibson.
Back on the road in his Nissan Leaf, Travis McCain is going down the list of people he's converted to the Church of EV.
Else? Oh, Bud. He was another
five people. He still keeps the truck around to haul his boat, but the Leaf has become his primary vehicle, and it's changed the way he looks at other cars.
On a nice day, even like today, I might typically drive with my windows down, and then as I pull up to an intersection, I roll my windows up so that I don't have to smell other car exhaust.
Getting finicky.
McCain is in the process of buying another Leaf. It'll be a delivery car for his business. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch visited Anchorage on Friday. She announced that the Department of Justice will formally consult with Alaska Native leaders and potentially create an Alaska-based position to develop solutions for the state's public safety challenges. During her day-long visit to the state, she also met with Native youth. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
The nine young people who met with the Attorney General were direct with her. Alaska, especially rural Alaska, has problems with public safety. Nivialik Brandt from Nome said in her experience, even if law enforcement does show up for the initial call, they don't follow through.
They will not turn in their paperwork. There's no investigation. Everything just stops when you talk to a police officer.
Mallory Johnson from Unalakleet said some of the problems exist in Alaska because national leaders don't understand the state. It's a beast unto itself. But she said there is a solution.
We should have the inherent right to govern ourselves.
Attorney General Lynch told the group their input matters.
While there's so much wisdom to be gained from our elders, there's so much truth to be heard from our young people. And the stories that you all have really are the ones that will inform me and my team as we go back and try and make sure that the Department of Justice can answer you, can answer your questions, can answer your concerns.
Lynch did not mention any specific plans for follow-ups. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Elizabeth Jenkins, Quentin Chandler, and Jennifer Canfield in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Ann Hillman and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University provides working professionals an educational pathway to career advancement. Through APU's hybrid course format of online and campus-based courses, students can focus on healthcare, finance, technology, and strategic leadership options. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.